I'll get started and we'll let everyone else filter in as they come. Okay, so now I will perform the amazing feat of very sketchily observing, sketchily outlining everything you need to know about the CMB in two lectures. Probably not, so. I'll try and fill in things to some degree of completeness, but for the next two lectures, a lot of it is gonna be take my word for it, and then there will be some of that filled in during the tutorial tomorrow, and then some of it filled in the notes, but I wish I had many more lectures. Okay, so last time we started to talk about photons. That was a qualitatively different calculation than what we had for dark matter in the relativistic regime. So, and now I'll actually change that to conformal time. So the equation we needed to solve was this. And actually, it wasn't zero. It was equal to some collisional term. So this was the Boltzmann equation. We needed to figure out some way of solving this for photons. And we defined the distribution function, because we're dealing with bosons, as the Bose-Einstein distribution. And then we chose to put the dependence on various things into this parameter we called theta. So all of the stuff that tells us about deviations from homogeneity is contained in that variable. And well, okay, so first of all, what was the distribution function? The distribution function was something that told us about the number density in phase space. So this is kind of like a phase space density that tells us how the various photons are distributed in position and momentum. And from this definition, sort of the reason why we did this, why we defined this variable theta, is that in the limit where theta was a function of position, time, and the direction of momenta only, then if I evaluate theta at a given position, for example, the most interesting position would be here and now, then this corresponded to a temperature anisotropy. So it literally would be, I look in different directions, this thing looks like a black body, and so what I would get is an anisotropic black body distribution. So if I look in this part of the sky, I'd see a nice black body curve with the peak around a certain position that would tell me the temperature was one value. And if I look in another part of the sky, I'd again see a perfect black body distribution where the peak has just shifted, and then I'd have something I'd call a different temperature. So if I pick a point, then this theta really tells me about the anisotropic temperature distribution that would be observed by someone who was sitting at that point at that time. And we can convert this p hat to a set of angles just by picking a reference frame. So I can always pick a reference frame, and then I can go from this direction of momenta, and the map would be as follows. So for a particular choice of reference frame, we'd have the following map between p hat and theta phi. So this really would look like a set of angles on the sky now, explicitly. Okay, so this is how we chose to parameterize the sort of deviation from homogeneity in the photon field. And it's more general, right? I mean, I don't have to necessarily pick here and now to evaluate theta at. I could pick, you know, theta in the Andromeda galaxy and ask, what would someone sitting there see? And that would fully be contained in theta. Okay. So theta contains information about what any observer in the entire universe would see at any time, including the observer who travels back in time to last year to hand in your homework assignment, because that's when it's due. Yep.
So x would be your position in space, and p is your momentum space. So what are the angles of momentum space corresponding to in space?
Sure, so I pick a point.
Because they're clearly not looking angle, like an observation angles.
No, it really is. So if I pick a position, then around that position, I now can define a reference frame. So we'll just define a reference frame x, y, and z, something like that. And now I can just measure momenta. So at this point, I have photons with a given momentum. Okay, and now I can just decompose that p into whatever basis I'm working in around this arbitrary point. Okay. And let's say I decided to do it not here, but there. Then again, now I could define another reference frame and I could evaluate that same momentum in this other reference frame. So around a given position, there's gonna be photons going through that position with various momenta. And I'm always free to change that into this reference frame. And now I can just define the unit vector p hat as follows. That's just a particular choice of reference frame.
So we're just going to redefine it as observation angles.
Yeah, basically, that's right. I guess more appropriately, we'd be more interested in these photons that were actually coming towards us. Okay, so it really is just I pick a point, and now I can define a basis around that point, and I can choose to express my momentum vectors in that new basis. Okay. So now there are a few useful expansions of this variable theta that I'll discuss. So the first one, of course, as in any linear theory, here theta is defined to be much, much less than 1. From the definition up there, it's just some dimensionless quantity, and we define it to be much, much less than 1. And so in linear theory, it's always convenient to go to Fourier space because all the Fourier modes decouple eventually. So we can do that. So theta as a function of x, p, and tau, we can express as theta as a function of k, p, tau by going to Fourier space. So that's one thing we can do. The second thing we can do is, since theta encodes the information about the temperature anisotropies seen by observers at different positions and at different times, it's convenient to go to harmonic space. So you can think of at each position, really what we're doing is we're defining delta t over t as a function of angles. And so we can decompose delta t over t into spherical harmonics. So we can define theta as a function of x, p hat, and tau. So here we screwed around with the variable x, right? So we changed x to k. Here what we're going to do is we're going to take this guy p hat and expand that into a new basis. So this we can write as a sum over L and a sum minus L to L of ALM. And now these ALMs are a function of the position and the time that I choose to evaluate theta at. And I stick all of the information about p hat into the YLMs. Okay, very good. And now we could, for example, tie these two together. So we could, for example, solve for the ALMs from theta in harmonic space, for example. So then I could get rid of both x and p hat and trade them for these harmonic space variables, which would now be k and lm. So in this case, I could get ALM as a function of x and tau. And that would just be stringing these two things together, d cubed k over 2 pi cubed e to the I k dot x integral over angles. So I'd extract the the Fourier coefficients by multiplying by the spherical harmonic and then integrating over all angles and using the orthogonality of the spherical harmonics, then this just picks out ALM for me. Okay, so if I knew this in Fourier space, now I could get it in terms of a set of ALMs. Okay, so these ALMs as a function of x and tau, they really encode all of the information in theta, right? So this tells me the harmonic space coefficients that I'd see at an arbitrary position in this photon field. And then the final thing we're going to do is define moments of the temperature field, so moments of theta. And this, again, is another expansion. So here what we're going to do is we've got theta, which we can write in Fourier space, for example, p hat and tau. And we can write this as a sum over Legendre polynomials. So this is negative I to the L, 2L plus 1, PL of the angle between k and p defined as follows. So this is mu, and of course that's just the cosine of the angle between k and p in a given basis, times theta as a function of k, p, oh sorry, theta as a function of k tau, excuse me, theta L. Okay, so these are referred to as the moments. And you can see here the clever thing that this does for us is it gives us a variable where we've totally removed the dependence on p hat. Okay, so these theta L's are independent of p hat, and that will be a convenience for later. So if you like, this is sort of like the ALMs. Again, with the ALMs, I traded p hat for some expansion in some basis. And here the same things happen. So I've traded p hat for something that encodes p hat times something that has no p hat dependence whatsoever. OK, and we can tie this expansion to our harmonic space expansion above, and we can also write these ALMs as a function of x and tau as an expansion in these moments. So I give this to you without proof, but this is something you can prove using the properties of the using the properties of the Legendre polynomials. Okay, so if I choose to write ALM as a function of these moments, then here you can see something kind of nice happen. So now my definition of these ALMs, you don't see p hat anywhere. Okay, so I've totally removed p hat from the discussion. So as long as I can find these moments, I can forget about p hat. So I'll just write that. So the convenience here is that we've eliminated p hat. Okay, so this is just a set of definitions and a dictionary that will help you translate between these different quantities. But just so you know, sort of you can think of as everything you'd want to know is contained in these ALMs evaluated at each position. That completely parameterizes all the information in this anisotropic photon field. And this is just a way to express it in terms of these various quantities. Okay, so now we can actually tie this to observables. One basic observable, of course, is ALM here and now. So I could go out and I could decompose the sky into spherical harmonics. And I could just see, what do I get? What do I get for the temperature anisotropies? So this would be, I don't know, how do I want to call this? Not statistical information, but actually like all of the information on the sky is contained in these ALMs. So this is like a precise encoding of all the information that there is. Typically what we do, though, is we make some assumptions. And these are good assumptions that can be attested, can be tested. So if we assume that theta is a random field, and actually it would be further assumption is that it's a statistically homogeneous random field, then we can make a little bit more progress and we can define a quantity that encodes all the information in these ALMs just based on their statistics. So if we assume that, then it follows that if we define correlation function between the ALMs, so ALM and ALM star, AL prime M prime star, and then this defines for us these so-called CLs, or the angular power spectrum. So what do I mean by statistically homogeneous, and what do I mean by these brackets, right? So what am I actually averaging over to compute this two-point function? So you can think of this either as one different realizations about a fixed point. And for us, the most interesting fixed point is just x here, tau now. Okay, so I could just, if it's a random field, I could imagine just making tons of universes and just sitting at this point and asking in my vicinity, what do these different realizations do? What do they mean? And then here, this would just be, what do I expect the variance to be in these different ALMs? Another way of looking at it, though, is that we have a fixed realization, and we want to basically look at different positions in this fixed realization. So because I have this field theta, and I know how to ask what would an observer at a different position in that field measure, that's encoded in these ALMs as a function of x and tau, then this could just be an ensemble average over different observer positions. Okay, and if this is a statistically homogeneous field, then these two statements should be totally equivalent. Okay, I can look at it either way. Okay, so that's what I'm averaging over. I'm averaging over either different realizations, of the universe if I fix my point, or one realization and I sort of sample it from different places. Those are both equivalent. And if we further assume, okay, so we have this assumption of statistical homogeneity, and for a field that is statistically homogeneous, if I were to take different realizations or sample different positions and look at correlations between theta as a function of two different momenta, then this thing necessarily is proportional to the delta function. So this would tell me that theta can be a function of k only. It only depends on the magnitude of k. Okay? It doesn't depend on the direction. It doesn't depend on the separation in k. So that follows from this assumption as well. And for a statistically homogeneous field, then you can see, well, CL, the angular power spectrum, actually contains all the information that there is. So this CL has everything. Now you can test that, so you could compute higher order correlation functions, and we'll talk a little bit about that in the next set of lectures by Paul McFadden. And there you'd see that the CMB is a, quote, random Gaussian field, and what we mean about Gaussianity is that, you know, sort of this two-point function tells me all the higher order correlation functions as well. So that's why this really contains all the information that there is.
I know Planck and other experiments are trying to test non-Gaussianity.
Right.
How do you go about doing that? If you can't use a power spectrum.
Yeah, so you define something called a bispectrum that Paul will talk about, and that's basically just looking at correlation functions between three ALMs. Okay. And then you use some of the properties of the sort of angular momentum addition, these Wigner 3J symbols, which I don't know if you've seen in quantum mechanics or elsewhere. And that defines for you this thing called a bispectrum.
And so the error we have in the non-Gaussian, like the non-Gaussianity we know about, or the errors there are
right.
in that, do they translate into errors on this CL? Because it seems like if the universe is non-Gaussian, these CLs are not as well defined.
Yeah.
So
excellent question. So this is an active area of research. I can point you to some very interesting papers that explore this question. But what do I really mean by non-Gaussianity? I sort of mean that the universe isn't really statistically homogeneous, not totally anymore. So one of the simplest forms of non-Gaussianity that I'm sure Paul will talk about is this local type non-Gaussianity, and that's parameterized by some number FNL. And basically what this tells you is that, let's say I had a very long wavelength modulation, then one way of thinking about this non-Gaussianity is that the amplitude of this two-point function here, for example, so theta of k squared, this is just schematic, so bear with me. So theta of k squared is actually some amplitude Okay, let's call this position x. Some amplitude is a function of x times some average, in a sense, of the two-point function. So that you get in here sort of more power in the peaks than in the troughs. That's one possibility. Okay. So in this example, schematically, you can see that it's not really statistically homogeneous anymore. Because if I happen to be in a place where there's a large bump in some modulating field, then I get a very large power spectrum. If I happen to be in a trough, then I have a very small power spectrum that I'd see. And so that's one type of non-Gaussianity, and that basically screws with this assumption. So now you can ask, okay, well, these thetas contain information about what every observer should see, independent of what time they live or where they are. Then you can go and you can calculate, you know, what are the implications of this picture for what I would observe? And for example, what would the error be on the power spectrum given that I don't know where I am in this picture, just a sort of theory error bar? And you can compute that, and you get interesting answers. And that's kind of an open question.
Is it small compared to like cosmic variance and things like that?
So some incarnation of this story in some papers claims that it depends on the number of e-folds of inflation, that if you have a lot of e-folds of inflation, then the error goes up, the error bar goes up. So these are papers by Sarah Shandera, who used to be a postdoc here, and Marlena Loverde, and some other authors.
So it's model dependent. It's not just, because I mean, we have bounds on this FNL.
Mm-hmm.
Can we not translate those bounds into errors on the CL, or is that, you don't do that model dependent?
Yeah, so the claim is that it depends on the number of e-folds, even in that case where we've measured FNL. Yeah. So I don't know the precise answer to your question, because that's an open area of investigation. But it's a good question. Okay, so let's go back to the simple world where everything is statistically homogeneous and I don't have non-Gaussianity. So that's just an aside. And in that simple world, I can now take this guy here and I can use that in my definition of these ALMs. So for example, that expression up there is probably the most useful one to use. And I can translate this into a statement about the angular power spectrum. So we'll take this, and it follows that, again, using some tricks of spherical harmonics and Legendre polynomials and whatnot, that I could turn this guy into the following. So CLs are just ALM. A star LM, so if I just impose that delta function and I make L, L prime equal, and M, M prime equal, then I can evaluate using the expressions that I have on the left, the power spectrum, and if I chose to write it in terms of these moments, then I get something like this. So the moments are a direct. So here, I guess, you know, I could take this, and now I could expand that in terms of the moments, and then I get the thing I have over there. I guess I'm skipping one step. But the punchline is that if I can calculate the moments, I can calculate the CLs. So I can go from the moments to the angular power spectrum. So then you can guess the name of the game is going to be to compute these guys here. And just schematically, this is going to be basically a definition. So take my word for it, and then we'll unpack it and get into some of the physics. So what we want to do is we want to connect the early and late universe. And so there's a lot of details that go into this. But if I just don't care about the details, then I can define for you the following. So I can say that theta, these moments, now can be written as a linear operator, which we'll call delta. And this is going to be a function of the magnitude of the momentum. So the assumption here is that the universe is the same in every direction. So I can get the evolution of any component of the wave number by looking at the magnitude. So I can just pick a direction and evaluate that linear mode. And then that applies to everything else. Times something that gives me information about the primordial universe. So this could be, say, the potential. So it's the gravitational potential. In fact, what we'll do is not use that, but to be consistent with what comes later, we will use this thing zeta. So zeta is the co-moving curvature perturbation. So we introduced this briefly when we talked about the different gauges. But this is a way to parameterize the fluctuations in the gravitational potential. And so we want to construct this map from something primordial. Okay, so this would be the thing that, for example, would be predicted by inflation or other early universe scenarios. So here's my prediction, and I want to turn my prediction into an observation. And so using this definition, if the two-point function really is all that there is, then I can relate the CLs that I observe to the properties of this primordial field that I predict through the following convenient formula. So just literally substituting in this definition. Now this correlator becomes a correlator for these primordial perturbations in zeta, and we're going to define this thing as the power spectrum. So this is just defined as the power spectrum for zeta. So here's all the, if I were to split this up, I've got my translator, which takes early to late, and I have my prediction, which tells me about the early universe. Erase that up so you can see it. So you can think of these deltas as just a linear map. So it's linear theory, right? I've got a bunch of Fourier modes. They're all decoupled. So I can just multiply them by the right number that turns my primordial prediction into the thing that I actually observe. And there's a lot of physics in this linear operator.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah, absolutely.
In this decomposition, how does the dimensional scaling usually distribute itself amongst these?
Good.
I feel like I've worked with this and I always messed up the dimension somehow, I don't know. So is the curvature theta or zeta of k, how does that scale with k?
Okay, that's a hard question. I'll try my best. Okay, so CL is usually measured in microkelvin squared. Okay.
Oh, okay, so this is a dimensional CL.
And I think, so the dimensions are all going to be in my definition of this guy here, right? Of this linear operator. So that is just arbitrary at this point. I told you this is a definition. So this is going to be the thing that sops up all of the dimensions.
Okay.
So k is in units of 1 over length, right? So we've got 1 over length times 1 over length squared. And the power spectrum is dimensionless. So I've got 1 over length cubed. So that means that this thing delta had better have units of microkelvin squared times length cubed, I guess.
Okay, and so you want your power spectrum to be dimensionless because, is there a reason for that, or?
Because zeta is a dimensionless number. And so if I have a correlator of zeta squared, then
before
that's going to be a dimensionless number.
Is that after you did the Fourier transform?
Okay, good point. Yeah. So I guess that's not entirely true. So zeta indeed as a function k and tau is d cubed k over 2 pi cubed e to the I k dot x times zeta as a function of x and tau, right? So this is dimensionless. Yeah, so indeed, I guess zeta in Fourier space has dimensions of k cubed, so 1 over length cubed. Yeah, you're right. Okay, so yeah, that guy would have dimensions of 1 over length cubed squared, so I guess that would make it L to the minus 3.
Okay, and so when you say your power spectrum is scale invariant, is that related? I feel like that's related to these dimensional scaling.
Yeah, so when we say the power spectrum is scale invariant, we mean that P of zeta is k to the zeroth power, so it doesn't scale with k.
Oh.
Now there's two different definitions of the power spectrum. I'll try to get this right.
Okay.
So there's one definition. Yeah, let's try and get this right. Okay, so there's one definition which is literally zeta k squared. I believe that's this guy. So there, if we just did this through and we turn this into a correlator between zeta at different x's, then we'd have two integrals. So we'd have d cubed k, so let's do zeta k prime, d cubed k prime over 2 pi to the sixth, e to the I k minus k prime dot, yeah, I guess I need to define x and x prime first, so e to the I k dot x, e to the I k prime dot x prime, and then I'd have a correlator between zeta x, zeta x prime. I don't know if I can do this real time.
Okay.
But let's talk after class.
Okay.
Sorry. I'm just going to get bogged down. But there's a dimensionless power spectrum. Let me just say that. This is a take my word for it statement. So there's a sort of dimensionless guy, and then there's a dimensionful guy. And the dimensionful guy goes like, for a scale invariance, k to the minus 3. And one must be careful. Okay, so let's talk after class, and then I promise tomorrow at the beginning of class I'll be careful. I'll tell you the distinction between the two. Okay, physics in delta. So we had drawn this, just to put this statement up here into pictures. So there's co-moving scale versus time. And we had drawn For a radiation or matter-dominated universe, we had the co-moving horizon, and that increases with time. And then if I have a particular mode function, so if I have a particular value of k, then in a matter radiation dominated universe, this thing starts out on super horizon scales. And we saw, at least for a dark matter, and you'll take my word for it, that it's true for radiation also, that out here the perturbations are, quote, frozen in. Okay, so they don't evolve in time. Now, the thing that actually doesn't evolve in time, there was a little bit of a cheat that I did before. The thing that is truly frozen is zeta. So zeta is something that is independent of time. And I believe that's something we'll discuss when we move on to the next part. So zeta is the thing that's really frozen. And out here on super horizon scales, zeta is the thing that tells me about the moments of the photon distribution, delta, the different components of dark matter, the density of dark matter, for example, velocities. There's a map between all of these things, and I hope I have time to construct that map tomorrow. So out here on super horizon scales, there's this map, right? So I can map my initial primordial zeta into initial conditions for these thetas, deltas, and velocities. And this delta L is sort of the thing that tells me about all the interesting physics that happens when this mode crosses the horizon, things evolve, the photons come to me from wherever they are, so that here, sort of today, delta is the thing that basically is just this linear operator that goes from through this process of constructing this map from zeta to the initial conditions for theta, going through horizon entry, having all the interesting physics happen, and then giving me what I see. Okay, so to figure out what actually goes in here, what we have to do to get delta, so you can think of delta as basically solving the differential, a set of differential equations for these theta L's, delta, velocities, et cetera, et cetera. So I basically have to solve from some initial condition for all of the evolution in these different components, and that's going to be the thing that tells me how to map some primordial thing onto the thing I observe in the universe. So we're just shoving all of that into this symbol. Okay, so let's talk about some of the physics. So let's go back to the Boltzmann equation. And talk about how that works. So we had that the total conformal time derivative of the distribution function should be equal to this collision term. And now let's see what we actually mean by that. So we'll do the left-hand side first. So f is a function of tau. It's a function of the position. It's a function of the magnitude of momenta. And it's a function of the direction of momenta. So in this total derivative with respect to time, I have to expand out in partial derivatives with respect to each of these quantities. So that means that df d tau, the total derivative, is the partial derivative of f with respect to tau. And then we just apply the chain rule. So it's the partial derivative of f with respect to xi times the derivative of xi with respect to tau. These are just the different components of the position vector, plus df dp times dp d tau, plus the partial derivative of f with respect to p hat the ith component of the direction times the derivative of the ith component in terms of tau. So we've just used the chain rule to expand this total derivative out. And now we have to talk about the physics that goes into each one of these things here. So the easiest thing to do first is to ask what to do with F. So in the following, we're going to always be expanding things to linear order. So we're still doing perturbation theory, and the justification of that is that this guy theta is much less than 1. Okay? So we're always going to work with the linearized theory. So the first thing we can do is we can expand out our distribution function. So that would be a zeroth order piece. The zeroth order piece is just e to the p over t minus 1. That's just the regular Bose-Einstein distribution, where t could in general be a function of time. And then you can expand out. So basically, we want to do a Taylor series in so in F here, we're going to do a Taylor series in theta times t. So we assume that theta times t is much, much less than t. And what you'll find is that you can rewrite the first order piece in this rather nice form as p times the derivative of f with respect to p. So the derivative of f with respect to t, you can see you're going to bring down a p. And then I can just do some rearranging and rewrite this as df dp with a minus sign. Times theta. And of course, theta is the thing that's a function of tau. It's a function of x. It's a function of p hat. And it's a function of p. So f0 is a function of tau and p only. So those are the various dependencies that we have to worry about. And so immediately, we can look at this set of equations here. And let's just label these different terms. 3, 4. Okay, so the easiest one is term 4. Because in term 4, we see we have df dp hat. And so when I hit that on this guy, you can see I get d theta dp hat, because f0 doesn't depend on p hat. So that's first order. So df dp hat I is already first order. And if I want to look at dp hat d tau, so what would change the direction of momentum of a photon in a homogeneous universe? The answer is nothing, right? There's nothing for a photon to really run into. So this term here is p hat I d tau is already first order. Okay, so term 4 is overall second order. So I can discard it. Okay, so that's nice. At first order, I can totally forget about this term that has to do with the changing of direction of momenta for the various photons. So the next easiest term is going to be term 2. So for term 2, we've already expanded f, but the thing that we need is dx I d tau. OK, so what we can do here is we can recall the definition of the four momentum. And we can rewrite dxi d tau as dxi d lambda, d lambda d tau, where lambda is some affine parameter. It's just arbitrary. And the four momentum for a photon, p mu, is dx mu d tau. Or d lambda, excuse me. So that's just the definition of the four momentum for a photon. And so here I can rewrite dxi d tau as the ith component of the four momentum over the zeroth component of the four momentum. So what is the four momentum? So the four momentum is defined, well, it's got a normalization, so it's null. So that's just the statement that the four momentum for a photon is null. And so we can expand this out. So G mu nu is going to contain both the background Robertson-Walker piece plus the perturbed piece. And we can do this in conformal Newtonian gauge. So the metric is a squared times negative 1 plus 2 psi d tau squared plus 1 plus 2 phi dx squared. And we can put that in here in this definition. So there we learn that a squared, negative a squared, 1 plus 2 psi times p0 squared plus a squared 1 plus 2 phi times pi squared is equal to 0. So that's just the normalization of the four momentum. And now we can make a definition. So there's a sum over I implicit in here. So we'll define p squared, which is the thing that appeared in all of these equations up here, as a squared 1 plus 2 phi, times pi squared. So why? So in a flat universe, that would be the thing that reduces to the three momentum. But you can just take it as a definition for now. So with this definition, we can define p0 as to first order p over a 1 minus psi, and pi as p times the direction of p over a 1 minus phi. So you can see what happened here. So I could solve for p0 in this expression. That's just p squared, for example, p0 squared is just what we called p squared divided by a squared 1 plus 2 psi. And if I expand that out to first order, I get p squared a squared. Let's take the root, actually. So I get p, a, and then if I expand out the denominator, that would be 1 minus psi, 2 times 1 half. Okay, so that's how we'd fit that in there. Okay, so I have these definitions for the components of the four momentum. And now I could compute what we wanted in the first place, which was dx I d tau. So that was p0 over, pi over p0. So we could stick this in and expand it out. So that's p hat over a 1 minus phi. And then in the denominator, we've got p over a 1 minus psi. So the p over a cancels, and I could expand out the 1 minus psi. So we'd get p hat in the ith direction, 1 minus phi plus psi. Okay, so that's our expression for dx d tau. And now we can look at this term here, term 2. And you can see that multiplying dxi d tau, we have df dxi. So that's the position derivative of the distribution function. And that only hits the first order piece. Okay. So this term here is first order. And so that means that for dxi d tau, I just keep the zeroth order piece. And the zeroth order piece is just p hat I. Okay, so we're just going to approximate this as p hat I. Okay, so we only need that zeroth order piece. So there's two terms left that we need to contend with. So the next term is 3. I need to know how things change, how the momentum changes in the distribution function, and how the momentum changes with tau. Yeah, it's term 3. So we need dp d tau. So to figure out how the momentum changes with time, we probably want to do something like solve the geodesic equation, which tells us how momenta change with the affine parameter. So the geodesic equation, of course, is dp mu d lambda, that's the four momentum for the photons. And that's negative gamma mu alpha beta p tilde alpha p tilde beta. So in the most recent incarnation of the notes, you will find the Christoffel symbols for the conformal Newtonian gauge. That will be useful for your homework too. And we'll just quote the answer, so I won't list them or derive them for you here. So if I take the zeroth component, then we get dp tilde 0 d lambda. And so we can rewrite that as d tau. If I want to play this, yeah, d tau d lambda times dp 0 d tau. And of course, d tau d lambda is just p 0. And you can see from above, I can convert dp d tau into a derivative of p with respect to tau. So that'll give me what I want in the end. And then on the right-hand side, we just have negative gamma 0 times p tilde alpha p tilde beta. So this gives me, we can just do that part, I guess. So p total 0, and then I'll have d tau of p over a times 1 minus psi. And then we can expand that out, and we'll get some set of stuff. I'll spare you all the details, but we'll just note here that okay. So we want to solve for dp d tau. And the answer, to cut to the chase, that you will get, I encourage you to try that out. Is the following. So this actually has a nice physical interpretation. we could have kind of guessed at the answer before we even started. So what changes the momentum of a photon in an expanding universe? Okay, of course, one is just the expansion of the universe, right? Photons redshift because they get stretched. And we can identify this term as doing that, right? So if I have a positive H, this is like H, then the universe is expanding. And so that's going to decrease the momentum. That's why you have the minus sign. So the second one is you could fall into potential wells. And that's this term. So if I have a potential well that is growing, what? Yeah, I guess actually more I meant this one. Sorry about that. So if I fall into a potential well, I'm basically traversing a region where the potential varies with distance. Okay. So if I fall into a growing potential well or something that's, you know, linearly dependent, for example, then I'm going to lose energy as I try and go up that steep slope. And then the third one is if I happen to be a photon and I'm moving through a potential well that is deepening or growing, then I'm going to change my energy as well. So this term here, if I have a potential that's growing with time, then I get an extra redshift because that potential is growing and it gets increasingly difficult for me to traverse it. So we have these three contributions here. Question.
Which one? I thought maybe the second one, but now I'm confused now. It may be the second or third, but which one would be like an example of the ISW effect?
So that would be this one. So if I have a potential that changes with time, then this would be the contribution that comes from that.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, we're out of time. So next time we're gonna put all of that together and finish deriving this equation. Sorry, I didn't quite get there. And then we'll write down a set of master equations that will be every equation you need to solve in order to get this thing we call delta. And then you'll also get a little bit more in the tutorial. So we'll see you tomorrow morning.